This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. It's a journey that requires collaboration, curiosity, and communication among farmers, researchers, agronomists, consultants, and extension. You're going to hear their stories and discover how and why they're working together to make sense out of what's happening in the soil. Hey there, welcome back to another episode of Soil Sense. I'm your host, Tim Hamrich. Today, Dr. Abby Wick and I get a real treat to sit down with Dr. Christopher Topp, principal investigator and associate member at the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center in St. Louis, Missouri. Chris runs a root biology lab at the Danforth Center, where they develop techniques to study root systems, both in the lab and in the field. Chris and his team work with a number of novel imaging approaches to better understand what's happening in root and soil biology beyond the current state of the art. Ultimately, Chris says he hopes this knowledge will be used for the benefit of farmers to improve both the productivity and the sustainability of our agricultural systems. Founded in 1998, the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center is a not-for-profit research institution with a mission to improve the human condition through plant science. Research, education, and outreach aim to have an impact at the nexus of food security and environment and position the St. Louis region as a world center for plant science. Chris is going to kick things off by talking about the fundamental insight or thesis that drives his work in the root biology lab and the types of outcomes he hopes his work will lead to for farmers.
I don't know if you even call it an insight, just observation, I think, is probably the right way to say it. The fundamental observation is that we know so little about root systems, their importance for, you know, supporting above ground aspects of the plant, their importance for impacting the soil and the feedback there. Really, root systems are the conduit of the sun, the energy of the sun, and through photosynthesis, and they really connect us to geology, you know, through biogeochemistry, pumping carbon into the soil. And, you know, this has real important, you know, impacts on plant health, plant productivity, soil health, and, you know, our ability to meet the challenges of the modern day, right? Which are to at least not decrease the amount of soil we have and the quality of it, if not to actually regenerate it, but also to feed a growing population under challenging conditions. And so, as a plant scientist, as a biologist, you go to the hard problems. There's a reason we don't know a lot about roots. They're hard to study. So what do we do first? Well, we need to develop better methods to study them. And I can't tell you that we have the secret sauce to studying them. We still do quite a lot of digging roots in the field and digging trenches and things like that. But we've also been able to bring in technologies that were in fact developed in biomedical sciences, right, with all of that research support. So for example, my group runs two X-ray tomography systems. It's the same technology that if you go to the dentist or, you know, you have an ailment and go to the doctor and get an X-ray scan, you would use to learn about the human body. Well, we can see roots with X-rays. That's the nice thing about them. We can see soil structure. We can see microbes that are living on the roots, that are living on the soil. So that's something new that we were able to bring to the table here at the Danforth Center. And I could go on, but that's the mindset, is to develop new technologies or bring them in from other areas and really learn how to apply them to roots. Once we do that, once we can see them or measure them in a meaningful way, then it's really every plant scientist's dream. We can look across the diversity of plants, the diversity of different species and plants that have been adapted to different environments, and understand how the roots in that environment or, you know, for that species are productive. And that natural variation is what we're able to assay. And then, you know, once we're able to get a good idea of what's the best kind of root system for a particular environment, we can then learn about mechanisms that allow us to breed or otherwise, you know, develop technologies that can improve root systems. And so that's the gambit, I guess.
Connect the dots for me between the work you're doing to understand what's happening in the roots and how that applies to like cover crops and carbon?
Well, I think the mindset that we have is that we need to think more about systems. And systems can mean lots of things, and they do mean lots of things. There's many scales and types of systems, but at a very large level, we need to think about systems and how things fit together. So cropping systems are obviously, I think the audience understands those well, much better than I do. But for something like cover crops, for example, we have not been breeding corn for the last 70 years in general, have not been breeding it to work with cover crops. And, you know, there's lots of conflicts that can be boiled down to interesting plant science questions. Some of them really fundamental plant science questions, like how do two root systems interact with each other in the soil? Do they grow differently? Do they sense each other? If so, how? If so, what are the implications of that for how they grow? Are they competing or are they collaborating? And so we're thinking really about cover crops and corn mainly, because I'm actually a corn geneticist for 25 years. That was my training. I like lots of other plants and lots of other crops, but there's only so many things we can do. We have to hold a few parameters. So we're mostly focused on corn cover crop systems for now. And so it's thinking about which cover crops are compatible, you know, with the corn, and what about their root systems, you know, makes them more or less compatible. And that can include literally, you know, trying to capture the same resources at the same time, but it also could include things like the chemicals that roots exude, the microbial ecology that they foster, certainly pores and other structural aspects of soil that, you know, make it harder or easier, for example, corn roots to get established and be efficient. You know, nitrogen cycling is also quite important. So I don't mean to claim at all that we are the first people to think about this. That's obviously not the case. But we do bring to the table some knowledge of root biology that I think is pretty advanced. We bring some tools to the study of roots that are pretty advanced. And when you think about cover crops as a plant scientist, it's really nice because the possibility space is wide. There's a lot of plant species. I know cereal rye is kind of canon and that's baked in. There's many reasons that you can make an argument for cereal rye, but there's a lot of other grass species. There's a lot of other legumes. There's a lot of other, you know, brassicas that can also be brought into the mix. And I think we're trying to really optimize how they work together, you know, to build soil and to support the cash crop. A lot of these species have been hardly domesticated. And if they have, they haven't been bred for the ecosystem services that, you know, at least the breadth of ecosystem services. And so we're pretty interested in that, is really, you know, not just measuring the plant traits, but the effects on the soil, the effects on residual fertilizer. Yeah, so we're measuring how much nitrous oxide and carbon dioxide is emitted. We're measuring what's leaving the system through the water, the soil itself, and the interaction of the different species. And we think if we can learn a few useful things, we can apply them in a meaningful way, because basically, I mean, corn plants have been optimized for a certain agricultural system, you know, for a while, and that is high inputs, right? Synthetic fertilizer, monoculture, other inputs. But for cover crops, this is not the case. And so I think we can make rapid gains in breeding if we have vetted known, you know, targets to breed on. That's the idea here, is we think we can make impact fastest with a cover crop work.
What are kind of the front runners for cover crops that are coming up in the system? And I know this will probably be specific to Missouri, but what do you see as really promising that we should put on our radar to learn more about or figure out how that would benefit a system?
Yeah, it would be premature for me to really pick a leading candidate here, but I'll use an example of, you know, something we learned from our cover crop experiment this year. You know, it's always pending. We're always processing and analyzing data that never stops. You know, we never have like the answer. We just have the most current answer. right? But, you know, cereal rye, of course, it does put on a lot of biomass up top. It's got a pretty hefty root system as well, but also has high carbon to nitrogen ratio that, you know, we think is one of the reasons why it can, you know, cause some yield drag with the corn crop. It takes a while to break down. It sucks up nitrogen for a little while the corn plant is, you know, still pretty sensitive to that. And, you know, there's other grasses we've found that put on a lot of above ground biomass, but actually quite a lot of root biomass as well. And those roots go deeper into the soil and also have a sort of a lower carbon to nitrogen ratio. So while they may not be quite as impressive as cereal rye up top, I think that we will find the implications for improving, you know, soil carbon and soil structure at deeper depths is going to potentially be greater. And I think that we will find that the timescale that it starts to really accelerate corn productivity will be increased. And so we're looking at winter wheat, some triticale. There's a handful of things. I don't want to just name a few leads, but it's more of the approach that we're taking. So don't go out and buy stocks in those, you know. But
you're going to make us check back in either with another episode or come to a field tour at your research center there to find the answers, huh?
Hey, and that would be fine. I'm looking forward to it. We're testing this out, right? So it may be that it's not the case. That's how science works. Science doesn't work and, you know, like, here's what we think is happening and now we're going to show that that's true. We're testing it. We're trying to do this at a large scale across a lot of different species. We're learning similarities and differences among them. Then based on what we know about how this system should be working, using plant science and increasingly soil science, although, you know, that is also a journey for my group. I have some people in the group with soil science knowledge, but I don't personally at all. I'm learning this from conversations with people like Abby and anyone else that is patient enough to listen to me, essentially. You know, I'm just trying to sponge this up. But we're also very interested in, you know, leguminous cover crops for obvious reasons. We've actually done quite a lot of work on nodule biology and have some really great tools for that. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, microbial nitrogen fixation is one obvious way that we can reduce our dependency on synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. And, you know, if we can learn to harness that, we don't have to make it, we don't have to move it, we don't have to apply it, you don't have to pay for it. I know there's a lot of talk out there about, and a lot of companies that are really pushing this, you know, nitrogen fixation. On first principles, it works. I mean, that's how natural systems work. The question is, can we learn enough about it at a fundamental level to really harness it in a productive way and consistent way, you know, for a real agricultural scale, right? And so we have to make that case, and that's what we're in the process of doing. So for something like legumes, it's a little simpler because the free living stuff is tough, but things that form nodules, you know, I don't think we have optimized for the amount of, you know, nodulation, amount of nitrogen fixation, probably even in soybean, but certainly not in hairy vetch, certainly not in some of the clovers, which are really interesting plants. They're very hard to work with genetically, but if we can crack a few nuts there, I think we could really be on to something. So at this point, we're surveying sort of how much nitrogen can these different plant species fix, and then, you know, how is that released to the corn plant? That's also a pinch point. They can make it, and then that doesn't mean it gets spoon-fed to the crop. But again, these are plant science questions, and we're plant scientists. So that may be a mystery now, but we're on the case.
This is great. And I think that's a fantastic example of like how you could focus on cover crops to benefit the system more by improving nodulation. What about on the corn side? What can you do to optimize a corn plant for production in a cover crop system?
Well, I'll start just with optimizing a corn plant root system we are trying to understand to what extent that affects the whole cover cropping system. So up until, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, we were mainly just focused on crop root genetics and corn being our flagship. So we've identified genes, for example, that can make roots grow deeper. They make a steeper root angle. They grow deeper into the soil. And in our, you know, preliminary field experiments, they have a higher nitrogen uptake efficiency. And we think that is because they get more roots in the ground deeper sooner. And they're basically just in contact with, and this isn't a conventional system. So, you know, we apply urea. We don't do it in the winter. We just apply it like right after we plant or shortly after the corn comes up. Obviously, there's lots of ways to add nitrogen, but that's a fairly standard way. And so even in that system, you know, it's not like we capture all the nitrogen, but because it's so, you know, so labile and water soluble, we just think there's more contact with more roots for longer. And that increases both yield and nitrogen uptake efficiency. And so we have several genes, and these genes are, they have natural variation. So there's been many, many thousands of corn genomes sequenced, different, let's say, genotypes that have been adapted to lots of different environments all over the world. And so when we find a few genes that we know can affect how roots grow, we just look across, use bioinformatics, right? Just use computational approaches to look at all these genomes and say, at gene X, there is a variation, right? Just mutations that have occurred in these genes where the gene works in a different way. And so we've now tied that to how it affects root growth. So we have a real, a pretty significant genetic toolbox for corn root system architecture. So we can make them shallower, we can make them deeper, we can make them branch more, and even respond to nitrogen in the soil more or less. Those are some of the tuning knobs that we think we have. To your actual question, how to make that compatible with a cover crop system, I don't know yet because we still don't know enough, but we're still developing that foundational knowledge base for these different cover crop root systems, right? And these different species. So the idea is we build that knowledge base, then we have hypotheses about how roots would be in conflict or be in collaboration with one another. And we use our genetic toolbox for corn to then sort of, we use the term rational design, which I think is not a bad way to put it. We use rational thinking and we design the system and then we test it out, right? So for a really deep-rooted cover crop, we may design a corn root system in one way. For a shallow-rooted one, we may design it in another way. And we can do functional tests as well to see how they take up certain resources. We do a lot of work with stable isotopes, which allow us to track where carbon and nitrogen is moving around in a system. And that's a really useful piece of our research platform.
I think my mind is just a little bit blown right now. I'm thinking of the corn root depth and adjusting that to fit with cover crops and where they're rooting and the resources they're using and competition versus compatibility. I mean, that's incredible to think about the potential for what that might do for designing these systems instead of just saying, well, throw in cereal rye radish and flax, which is usually what I recommend because it's easy and it's manageable in these systems. But how can we tailor that to actually put them on the fast track for seeing these benefits sooner or see more of them even in that same period of time? That just, my mind is blown.
that's quite a compliment. So thank you. But I'm glad you did bring up the sort of cover crop mix because I think that's an area that really we could really make some progress in. I'm a pretty serious, well, I shouldn't say that on this podcast, considering the audience, but I'm a very enthusiastic backyard gardener. And, you know, I've grown cover crops in my backyard and different mixtures that I've, you know, bought commercially for many years. And just like most of us, you know, it's the rye and maybe the vetch that, at least in this part of the country, that always seem to win. And that's sort of phenomenological in my backyard. But there's plant biology reasons for that. And so coming up with species and traits of those species that are compatible, you know, being able to use mixtures and sort of optimizing the mixtures of cover crops, I think, will be quite useful, you know, to advance our sustainability goals if we can do that.
That is cool. Could you just talk about where the research is today and what you see, you know, what you see coming in the foreseeable future about how this might get out to growers actually growing, you know, cover crops in corn that are more optimized in this way?
Well, so, you know, in brief, what we've established here is a program for developing this foundational knowledge base, both above and below ground, for many different cover crop species and as many mixtures as we can squeeze in. Okay, so there's about 30 species or so, you know, and about 10 mixtures. And we intend for these to be long-term experiments, meaning we've started basically year one. So we're measuring lots about the soil, aggregate stability, soil organic matter, nutrition. We're doing X-ray scans of soil cores to get pore structure and water infiltration. We've already planted corn. Farmer Dennis planted the corn for us. Very grateful to him. You know, and we'll continue to do this year on year and measure these effects and just really build that consistent foundational knowledge base year on year. I think we'll probably really start to see the fruition of this in 3 to 5 years in terms of that system really becoming mature. That's my expectation. But there's a lot we'll learn along the way. So maybe the most obvious thing we can do is just attract local, you know, farmers and let them help guide our research, just to lower the stigma or the barriers, and to show them eventually data, or not even data, maybe just physical, like, here's the changes to the soil. So we do hope to be a research in that regard. At the Danforth Center, we do, you know, develop and maintain IP. You know, that IP is basically, we keep it so that we can make sure it gets out into the world and it's not behind a paywall, essentially, right? And so licensing IP where it's still free to use for people that need it, but, you know, a company like our next door neighbor, Bayer, maybe someday they'll be interested in some of our IP and could make it happen at a large scale. Another possibility, and this is something that we have a very entrepreneurial bent here, and we have basically the means to develop. We have a Danforth technology company. And so a principal investigator like me, if there's really interesting findings, that's, you know, where we have some IP, we could start a company ourselves. That's certainly a possibility. And, you know, I still have a lot of homework to do in terms of getting in touch with existing cover crop breeding companies, but that's something that's really on my map. And I'm hoping to, you know, be in touch with them and bring them some data that's compelling enough to have them interested in continuing the conversation. So that's my plan, such as it is. But, you know, a lot of this is still in progress.
Let's give you a chance for kind of last comments here. Anything you want to say, especially to an audience of farmers about the work you're doing who are interested in how this kind of gets to them?
I would like to say that know that there are people like me, so dedicated plant scientists who are genuinely motivated, interested, and obliged. I mean, I genuinely feel that as a moral obligation for me to take the research platform that I have. I mean, it's public funding, right? These are federal grants that we run these projects on, and in some cases, a few private gifts, but it's a real obligation for me. And I am absolutely focused on making a difference. So know we're out there, but also know that many of us know that we need your help. We need your support. We need your interest. So even if you are finishing listening to this podcast and you're thinking, this guy got some things wrong, let's just say that, or I see it differently, I'm open to this. I'm here to learn, and I'm here to navigate some difficult problems, but use the resources and the things that I'm bringing to meet the challenge. And that's all I'm focused on. And many of my colleagues have very much the same mindset. So it's always very interesting to take the thing that you've internalized that you really know and understand and kind of put it out there, right? And try to collaborate and try to work in an interdisciplinary way when you know the solution will involve many different groups of people. It's a complex problem, and you know, there's no magic bullet to this. And so I appreciate you listening to this podcast. I hope you consume more sort of media about this, the science behind what's happening. And I hope also that you find ways to give us feedback and contribute. It could be an email to me. It could be coming to a field day or something. And you know, don't be shy about that, because we have a lot to learn from our side. And I think literally the world will benefit from it. You know, those are the stakes, right? So yeah, let's do this.
And really, that's what this podcast is all about: learning from each other and collaborating for the benefit of healthier soils everywhere. Thank you so much to Dr. Christopher Topp for being on the show today. We'll go ahead and leave a link in the show notes where you can go learn more about his work. And if you'd like, take him up on his offer to get in touch. Thanks so much to our sponsors of this season of Soil Sense: the North Central Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, the North Dakota Corn Council, the North Dakota Wheat Commission, the North Dakota Soybean Council, the North Harvest Dry Bean Association, the North Dakota Barley Council, and Anheuser-Busch. If you're getting value from this podcast, leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and share your favorite episodes on social media using the hashtag Soil Sense. We'll be back with more great soil health content in a couple of days.